everybody, and welcome to episode 7 of Scholarly Peers Podcast. I'm your host today, Sin Wang, and joining me today is Dr. Yuso Nieminen. Welcome, Yuso.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start by briefly telling us a little bit about yourself, your academic background, and of course your experience in peer review.
Yeah, so hello everyone, I'm Dr. Yuso Nieminen. I'm an assistant professor at the Faculty of Education at the University of Hong Kong and a research fellow at the Center for Research in Assessment and Digital Learning at Deakin University. And my research concerns assessment and feedback, mostly in the context of higher education. And I'm often taking a social, cultural, and political approach to the issues of assessment in this context. But actually, my background is not in academia originally. I am a teacher. I'm a mathematics teacher and an ICT teacher as my background. I'm actually also a special education teacher. So that's really something that I want to mention. So my soul is really a soul of a teacher rather than the soul of an academic, I could say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I also know you, so you have a lot of peer review experience, and I think you are an associate editor of a higher education journal as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experience as a peer reviewer or an editor?
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, I am an associate editor at HERD. That has been a very, very formative experience for me as an early career researcher to learn about the secrets of the peer review processes. My background in peer review goes back to the rather early days of my PhD career. So I did my PhD in rather niche area of self-assessment in undergraduate mathematics education, which is not a field that would have too much research in it. So that means that already during my early days, I was asked to do peer reviews by editors who knew me and who knew my work. So I've been doing peer reviews almost since day one of my academic career, and that has really been one of the cornerstones for me to learn of how to do research.
Right. So for the audience who may not know HERD, so that's the Higher Education Research and Development Journal. That's an excellent journal in higher education. And obviously, we all have very positive experience with that journal. So I'm very interested in knowing a little bit more about your peer review experiences. First, as an author, maybe. So can you share with us one or some unforgettable peer review experiences as an author?
Yeah. I was thinking about this, and I realize that quite often when you ask this kind of a question, like I think colleagues tend to start thinking about their experiences with the continuum of, you know, positive and negative experiences, and then they might come up with a very good positive experience of getting praise on their article, or the other way around, getting some very critical comments by reviewers who really dislike your work, and then that might be framed as some kind of a negative experience. And I actually realized that that's not a very helpful way for me to start dividing my peer review experiences. So I went for helpful and not helpful experiences instead when I was thinking about this question beforehand. And I wanted to share one experience that was extremely unhelpful as an author. And it concerned my final PhD article. So I did my PhD in Finland, where it is very common in education to do your PhD by publication, which means that before you write your thesis, you need to publish 3 or 4 journal articles. And I had submitted my final article, so I already had some experience of peer review. I had some experience of working with academic journals, but not too much. I was still in the very early days of my academic career. And I submitted my qualitative work on something on power relations in assessment, critical stuff Foucault mentioned. I submitted my work to a higher education journal, a highly regarded journal, and it came back quite soon with a rejection, which at the time, of course, felt a bit bad. But what was funny was that there was one reviewer who really disliked my work, and I actually and the comments that the reviewer wrote me were so funny that I actually printed them in my PhD dissertation, because why not? And I just wanted to share you this these awesome words that the reviewer wrote me. They wrote that the manuscript is not technically solid at all. No modeling, no theoretical analysis, no quantitative results, no figures, no tables. It should be rejected directly. So this was my first experience of getting qualitative work rejected on the basis of not having any statistical models in the papers, which is, I think, a very interesting argument. And I remember feeling, I mean, obviously bad, because it was only one of my first journal articles that I had ever submitted. But at the same time, I felt so unhelpful. There was nothing in these comments that I could use to develop my work. There was not one single comment that I could use to do that. And that felt, I felt almost like betrayed. And this was a very good journal. And so that experiment really, really stuck on me. And I think it still drives me as an author and as a reviewer to offer better peer feedback myself. I don't want anyone to read my review and think that there's absolutely nothing that they can use to develop their argumentation and their paper. But of course, I also have more helpful, more positive experiences of peer review as well. And another thing I wanted to share was a helpful experience. And this one is not from a higher ed journal, but it is an experience based on a math education journal. And my personal experience is a bit anecdotal. There's no research backing this up, but my personal experience is that the reviews tend to be of higher quality than in higher education journals. There's often many reviewers, more than two, and often just the amount of feedback is greater and the quality as well. And I think it was already a couple of years ago, we submitted a very ambitious literature review to a very highly regarded math journal with my colleagues. It's still not published. And at first it received extremely critical, I guess you could call them negative comments, but the comments were extremely helpful. And the reviewers, I think there must have been like four or five of them. And I just checked that there was 18 pages of comments. So you rarely get this amount of feedback from higher education journals. I remember feeling like destroyed after reading these comments. I had spent so much time leading this project with my awesome team of researchers. It was a lot of work. And then these reviewers, they had found so many flaws in our work. The literature review was not sound. Some parts of the process were just absolutely not of high quality. And some of the discussion points we had were just made no sense. And you know, there were a lot of critical comments, but they were actually on point. And it took me a lot of time to use all my feedback literacy. I had to deal with the comments. We had to redo the whole literature review from scratch. And that was years of work. It was so painful, but so very formative. And actually, we submitted the revisions quite a while ago, and I got the paper back only a couple of weeks ago. And one of the original reviewers wrote, and this is a quote, a citation, "Rarely, if ever, have I been so pleased by a revision. I thank the authors for taking the comments so seriously and for responding to them in spirit rather than only by rote." And this really makes me feel proud of the work that we've done. And I must emphasize that this is an experience of negative comments. The comments were so critical. They were really, they felt bad. But oh my goodness, how helpful they were.
Okay, wow, that's two totally different experiences. And I really like the way how you try to make sense of the experience, not just as regarding the comments as positive or negative, but really whether the process is helpful or slightly less helpful to you personally. And also, I think from what you shared, what I have been thinking is it takes two to make the feedback experience helpful, because, you know, even though the same person, I mean, a different person receives 18 pages of constructive feedback, but being totally destroyed using your word and not having the courage to take on the comments and to revise based on the comments, the experience wouldn't be as helpful as the one that you just described to us. So I think a lot to think about. I mean, and you hinted on, you know, that the need for for education and, you know, learning to be a reviewer and, you know, having that those biases, you know, quantitative researchers often have. And I think we'll touch on those later on in some of the questions. So thank you very much for sharing with us your experiences as an author. So now let's put on our peer reviewer hats or our journal editor's hat and to think about maybe some of your, again, unforgettable experiences, but this time on the side, being a reviewer or, you know, as an associate editor, handling the review process.
Yeah, I thought that I would actually share my very first experience of peer review because it's a very good example of my overall approach to peer review at this later stage of my career. So I remember this moment very, very clearly. I was actually I was hiking in Tasmania, Australia, with my PhD supervisor, the most awesome Dr. Laura Tuohilampi. And we were visiting the University of Tasmania, and we were having a little break, and we were just hiking in the bushes of Launceston. And I got an email from this professor who knew my work. Again, as I mentioned before, I was working in a very niche area, so not too many researchers working in this area, and the editor happened to know me, and they thought that it would be okay to ask me to review this manuscript, even though I was still a PhD student. And I read this email where I was asked to be a reviewer, and I got so happy. I thought that someone was recognizing my work, someone was recognizing my professionalism in this field of assessment research in math education, and I was like dancing out of joy, and my supervisor was laughing so much, and she told me that, oh, you're laughing now, but you're not going to be laughing when you'll get your 10th review invitation. And I remember using so much time and resources to come up with a very professional sound review. I read the paper so many times. I must have written like, not kidding, like 8, 9, 10 pages of comments. I was inspired by the paper. It was an excellent paper, by the way. But there was also a lot to develop. And I, even though I was a PhD student, I must say that the editor had made a pretty nice decision to let me review because I was able to offer some high quality comments because it was, again, operating in a very niche area of self-assessment and undergraduate math education. So, and I did that and I submitted the review. And even then I felt like the editor was, obviously I don't know if this is true, but I had this feeling that if I would have failed this task, if I would have offered low quality comments for the manuscript, the editor might know me and the editor might talk to others and tell them that, oh, you was that guy who was not even able to handle this review invitation. And I felt I really need to show that as an early career researcher, I'm able to do this. And I used a lot of resources for that. And then when the manuscript got the final decision and I could read the other reviews as well, they were very, very short and they were not of high quality in any kind of way. And I remember thinking, I felt almost like a bit betrayed. I was like, hey, aren't we all supposed to be writing these high quality reviews? What's going on? And I wanted to share this experience because this is still something that I feel like as an assistant professor. I do think that especially in the higher journals, the quality of peer feedback is not always very high. Of course, there's a lot of very good reasons for this. The pandemic as one of them, that there's a war going on in Europe. There's a lot of things going on that, as we all know, affects peer review processes as it does affect everything in academia and beyond academia. But even then, I still often get a similar feeling when I submit my reviews and know the other reviews that might be just one paragraph or something very short or something that has missed some crucial bits of work that I have noticed that I think should not be missed by a peer reviewer. For example, some very big flaws in the research design or something like that.
Okay, right. So I think you mentioned something quite interesting in your response just now about variations across academic disciplines, and you mentioned the from your experience at least that quality of feedback in a particular discipline or field it's kind of higher than in other one. have you pondered upon the reason behind? I mean, is it because of the way that researchers are trained, or is it because of the tradition of the discipline, or the expectations spelled out by the journals? Maybe what may be the reason from your own observation?
This is an excellent question. It's something that I think I've needed to reflect upon for all these years in academia. And my answer will be anecdotal and based on my personal experiences. There, again, no research backing this up. I'm so used to, like, you know, as a professional, through my professional identity, you always offer some comments based on, like, I don't know, 5 references. This is not one of them. But my academic guess would be that maybe the field of mathematics education is a bit tighter. Perhaps this field has a more clear common goal for all this research. We would have people coming from different paradigms, people doing highly critical quality stuff, people doing quantitative modeling, different kinds of things, but everyone kind of shares the same goal of enhancing the quality of mathematics education. And I feel like higher education is just more disparate, it's not a unified field in a similar way. For me personally, it feels like it consists of a couple of different silos, such as assessment and feedback research or psychological studies on, I don't know, student well-being, things like that. And then there's an own separate silo for critical higher ed research. And I've pondered that perhaps this is at least one of the answers to the question. Perhaps in higher journals, the only thing that is connecting us is the context of higher education, but perhaps not the ultimate goal of why we do research. What is this all for? I think this is a bit clearer in math education, but if this answer sounded a bit confused, this is because I don't because it is. I don't know if you have any insights on this.
No, I mean I also work in different fields. I mean, in language education as well, apart from higher education. I don't see that much of a difference, though. I don't know whether that's a good sign or not, but I mean, obviously, the way that people are trained, and also the size of the field and the variations within the field that are, you know, obviously contribute to the differences. It's a very interesting research topic. At least the way that we reflect on it, it has a lot of implications for us. I mean, preparing early career researchers and doctoral students for peer review as well. So, but I don't have the answer like you, but it will be quite interesting to think about it collectively. Let's think about, let's go a little bit deeper into your experience learning how to navigate journal peer review. And you mentioned when you did your PhD in Finland, it was by publication. So, and you explained briefly the model, which can be quite different from some of the models in other parts of the world. So you had the experience of submitting manuscripts quite early on, and you had the privilege of being supported by your supervisors in the peer review experience. I wonder if that helps you in learning how to navigate the whole peer review process, or you find it quite an independent process after all.
Yeah, my experience about that PhD by publication model is that it's kind of, you get pushed into the deep end of the swimming pool, and then you just need to learn how to swim. So a lot of that learning experience was very messy and complex. I'm an assessment researcher. I'm used to thinking about learning as a rather linear process, and you can assess different steps of the process and so forth. But my PhD experience was nothing like that. And this also applies for my experience of learning how to do peer review. It was a messy learning experience because there's no formal training for that. I guess some universities might have a course for PhD scholars for how to do this, but it's more or less random. It's not systematic. And my university certainly didn't have that. It was more about learning as you were doing and learning from the anecdotal experiences of everyone around you, because your supervisor might offer you some advice based on their own experience. Again, none of my supervisors had formal formal training in how to do peer review. I guess that would be more or less rare. But And then you might learn from the anecdotal experience of your friends, your colleagues. So, and then you get your PhD, and then you're just somehow supposed to be done with the process. It's been a very interesting, messy learning experience.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a question that a response that I kept hearing from my guests that there weren't a lot of systematic training in terms of journal peer review. A lot of the so-called training, it's learning through doing. You got an invitation by accident or through the connection of your supervisor, and you were brave enough to accept that invitation. You kind of just get started as a peer reviewer. And you of course, heard stories from your peers, you know, read things on Twitter. This is how most people I know learn about peer review. And all of my guests talked about the need for more systemic training. But I wonder, I mean, just trying to be critical, not cynical, but it's what's the best way to learn journal peer review? Is it really through systemic training, a structured course, or, you know, or really hands-on, getting messy, getting dirty with your hands? I don't know. I may move the questions around, you know, I may be talking about question number six now, but what's your view? What's the best way to support early career researchers?
Well, obviously some kind of formal training, it would be an answer for this question. And yeah, as you noted, many previous guests in the podcast have already mentioned that. So I won't go into the depths of that. But one of the things I wanted to mention is networking of early career researchers. That has been very, very formative for me as an ECR. Having some kind of a Slack channel or WhatsApp group for early career researchers where they can share their reviews and learn from them. That has been extremely helpful for me. And sometimes with my fellow then PhD student friends, we might have just gone to a cafe or to a bar and grab a glass of wine and talk about the peer review experiences that we've had, or the specific peer review of a specific article that someone has received. And through this kind of just the social learning process, we all learn from each other. That was extremely helpful. I really think that you shouldn't be doing this just by yourself. Like, for example, attending a formal peer review workshop by yourself might not be as helpful as having an informal, peer feedback setting for where you can learn. That. So that's my two cents for this question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think it's really a combination of both, right? So, you know, having a structured introductory training can help, but then as you go along, what you need the most is support from your peers and sharing genuine concerns and maybe successes, you know, that would really help. Yeah. Going back to the question about challenges, I mean, you started your peer review journey while you were doing a PhD. And of course, I'm sure there were challenges as you received your first ever peer review report or decision letter from an editor. Do you still remember your response when you received your first decision letter? What was it like?
Actually, yes, I do. Oh, and it's a very emotional one. I didn't even think about sharing it, but now that you reminded me about it, I was traveling on a very long flight from Australia back to Europe, and after traveling for like 25 hours or something, I landed on the airport. I was very, very tired, and I connected to the airport Wi-Fi and noticed that I had received a couple of emails, and one of them was the decision letter. And I was so extremely tired and so nervous because it was the decision letter for my first PhD article. And I sat down on a bench at the airport and I checked the email, and it was major revisions. But at the time, I didn't really know what it meant. I'm not from an academic background, so there were a lot of details that were still very unclear to me. And I kind of thought that it was accepted with major revisions. Now I know that that's not always the case. But I was so tired that I actually started to cry. And then some person came to ask me, like, are you okay? And I was like, no. It was a very, very funny moment learning about academia in a very emotional way. And then I called my PhD supervisor, and she was like, It's not exactly accepted yet, but it's a very good thing that you got major revisions. But there's a bit of a difference there. So yeah, that was a funny experience that I definitely remember for the rest of my career.
Right. Okay. Nice. Going back to our question about supporting early career researchers or doctoral students, you mentioned about the importance of networking, of staying connected with like-minded people. And you, I think one of the other things that a lot of ECRs are thinking is that they're thinking about opportunities to get involved in peer review, as a reviewer, I mean. And you shared your experience earlier on about being involved in a very niche area so that you kind of got that opportunity from being known to editors. I mean, for other PhD candidates, they may be working in a field that's quite broad and diverse, for example, in higher education, that it's quite hard for them to get known from editors. What are your suggestions for them if they want to get involved in peer review? And I know a lot of them, and including us before, thinking about whether we are qualified, and we talk about being qualified as a peer reviewer. What should be their first step?
That's a very good question. One practice, this is not the answer, this is just one answer, is a practice that I've noticed is not too uncommon in the math education field. And that is that PhD students are working on a peer review together with their supervisor and to learn about the process. And then in the review, it is stated that this review has been written by a PhD student but under the supervision of their supervisor. And I think this might work in fields beyond math education, and I would be glad to see used more often, because quite often PhD students, when they are working in their own niche area, they are professionals in their own work, especially if they have already been working on that for a couple of years, or if they have already published something like that. So that's one answer. Now I kind of forgot about what was your question.
No. I think that's perfectly fine. I mean, and a relevant answer. I'm just asking about what should be the first step for early career researchers or doctoral students if they want to get involved in peer review. And I think through their supervisors, that's definitely one of the best ways. I mean, and so I remember in the past, you know, when my supervisor maybe did not have time to review, and they thought I had the expertise to review, and they forwarded the review request to me. And you know, that's also sometimes a way to get involved. And once you are in the system, so to speak, yes, you know, your name gets reappearing, and I don't really like the numerical scores that the system sometimes assigned to reviewers, but I mean, there are indications that, you know, you are active in review and you produce good reports, and editors will come back to you for sure. I mean, because it's hard to find peer reviewers these days, right? But I'm very interested in knowing a little bit more about your collaborative model, because I don't think that's very common in higher education, for example. Mm-hmm. But do you think that's a model that would benefit everybody? I mean, in getting PhD students as a co-reviewer, we talk about co-author, but co-reviewing, do you see potential there, you know, in higher education peer review as well?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think for me personally, it's two separate things to work on a peer review by myself or with a team. And as a PhD student, I was, because the PhD by publication model that does require quite a lot of independence. You are in charge of the whole process. So you are required to mostly work on the reviews by yourself as well to learn. Obviously, your supervisors are supporting you as they are supposed to, but it's still your process, your learning process. So having some kind of a team that supports you while you're working with reviews, that's, to me, that's a whole another thing. When you're working on a review just by yourself, you are the one who needs to manage your emotions and who needs to take actions based on the reviews, whether they are helpful or unhelpful, and that you need to convince the editor by yourself. When you are able to have chats with your colleagues, about everything, about the quality of the paper, but also about your emotions, when you're able to just, open your Zoom and have a rant about the some of the reviewer comments, things like that. It really changes everything. So mm-hmm. having some kind of a community, whether that's on Twitter or through other social media, whether it's with other ECRs in your own institution, mm-hmm. whatever the community is, it really has the potential of enhancing peer reviews, mm-hmm. I think.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I always end each episode with this question. It's about a piece of advice that you would give to early career researchers or doctoral students who may be thinking about submitting their first ever manuscript to a journal. And you mentioned it was an emotional roller coaster ride for you when you receive your first decision letter. So a lot of the PhD students now may be thinking about, should I do that? You know, when should I do that? Should I do it during my PhD or should I do it afterwards? And when is the right time to submit? There are a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, a lot of worries. What advice would you give them if they are thinking about doing it?
Oh goodness, to pick one advice. Perhaps I could advise the PhD students to very carefully pick the right home for your study. Mm-hmm. And this is a matter of the field. For example, when you're working in higher education, if you collect data for one specific discipline, for example, in my case, it's often math education. You have so many different options for journals. I could submit my work to math education journals that also accept stuff from higher education, or I could go for a more general higher education journal, and I could frame my study as a general study that has been conducted in the context of math education, but that's only one census that really addresses that. I could go for a general education journal. If my work has some kinds of critical aspects, I could go for a critical education journal. You know, there's so many different options, and that ocean of journals, that's very tricky to navigate. And to find the best possible home for your study, that's so tricky, and I'm still learning. I don't think anyone can ever be completely ready with this or done with this process. And a part of that learning process is to learn how to be strategic when you're publishing. This is something that my supervisors, that they really taught me to do this, and it was very helpful for me. And one of the things I learned over my own PhD was method that I call spaghetti on the wall. So sometimes you're in a hurry. This often happens in your PhD. You need to publish something quickly, and then you might need to pick a journal that you know, based on perhaps your supervisors, is rather quick. And these journals might not be the best journals in your field, and that's fine. Sometimes we do need to do practical solutions, but sometimes you're not in a hurry, and you might even want to try a better journal or even a leading journal in your field. And this is when you can throw the spaghetti on the wall and submit your work to a very good journal and see if it sticks. It might not. And if it doesn't, it doesn't matter if you're not in a hurry. And then the spaghetti just slowly comes down on the wall and you just submit it to another journal. But so this way, some of my work has really been published in rather good journals, even though as an early career researcher, I really didn't think that I would have had the chance of doing that. Mm-hmm. And I just try to forget about the imposter syndrome by just throwing the spaghetti on the wall without thinking about it for too much. but where to throw your spaghetti? That's a tricky question. And here again, your supervisors and your fellow colleagues are very, very helpful when you ponder about whether to go for higher journal, general education journal, and so forth. So perhaps my final piece of advice, you asked for one piece of advice, I've given like seven, but again, it goes back to the idea of communal learning and a community. So reach out for comments and thoughts and insights from everyone around you. And if you don't have this kind of support at your own institution, for example, other PhD students, social media personally has been very influential for me to, for example, to ask about a specific experience of a journal. There are some journals that I wouldn't recommend for new PhD students. There are some journals that I would definitely recommend for new PhD students. So all this knowledge is somewhere out there, but you most certainly cannot find it from the websites of the journals. So all this crave, hidden academic knowledge is you need to be able to identify it when you're picking the right field and the right journal for your specific study.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Yusuf, for very useful advice. I mean, I love your imagery. I mean, don't be afraid to aim high, you know, just throw the spaghetti again on the wall and see if it sticks. If it doesn't, do it again. And also the importance of having a kind of like an insider's perspective and knowledge. And that's the importance of having a community, I think. So thank you very much, Yusuf, for sharing your experiences and the advice that you, you just shared with us. Thank you so much.